everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Substation podcast. My name is Emma Burns.
And my name is Tom Edwards.
And in this episode, we're very excited to have a guest, Ed Burkett, with us.
Hi, Emma.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
Good, thank you. Nice to see you both.
So in this episode, we're going to focus in on a topic very close, I think, to all of our hearts, but especially Ed's, which is the topic of locational pricing. So Ed, do you want to kick us off with describing what that is in first principles?
Sure. So when we're talking about locational pricing, we're talking about how electricity is priced in the wholesale market. And today in Great Britain, we have a form of uniform pricing or national pricing, where we have a single electricity price across Great Britain in each 30-minute period. So it's 30-minute trading periods, 48 of those per day. But there is the same wholesale electricity price in each of those periods. There are other ways of pricing electricity. You can price it on a regional basis, as they do in Italy, for example, where there are six, I believe, regions. And that's known as regional pricing or zonal pricing in the literature. And then alternatively, you can go more granular than that, and you can go to local pricing, where you have hundreds or thousands of different prices at individual pricing nodes. So it's also known as nodal pricing. And so those are your three options. You've got national pricing, you've got regional pricing, and you've got local pricing, also known as nodal pricing or locational marginal pricing.
And why do we want locational pricing in the first place? Why is sort of a single price zone not good enough?
So the whole theory of electricity markets and how they're priced is that you have supply and demand meeting at a point where it sets a price. And in that sense, it's a pretty pure economics experiment, really. And that historically has served us quite well, where we have one price across Great Britain, there's supply available to offer into the market, and then there's demand that wants to take off. The issue that we've seen in recent years is that we now have generation and demand concentrated in different areas of the country at different times of day. And what that means is that you have network constraints where you can't get power from one part of the country to another. And so for example, you can't get electricity out of Scotland down to England when it's windy, because the lines between Scotland and England are full. And what that means is that your assumption when you have national pricing is that any generator anywhere in the country can meet demand from any customer anywhere in the country. And that is the assumption you're making implicitly when you have national pricing. The problem that we're experiencing now is that assumption is breaking down, and it's no longer the case that any generator anywhere in the country can provide electricity to any customer anywhere in the country. And so that leads to an inefficient market where the system operator, National Grid, ESO, has to step in and sort of unwind the market and make sure that all of the flows on the electricity network actually reflect the physics of the electricity network.
So it used to be, so this all comes out of a policy in the 2000s, I think, called Connect and Manage. So it used to be, or the idea, the national pricing idea was that you could connect to the system, but you had to wait until the network operators said it would be okay for you to connect and that they were sure that your power would be able to flow without causing any issues. That hits the, that basically means that, well, you've got lots of people who want to connect in one area. It takes a long time to build that infrastructure. So the government said to the network companies, okay, instead of invest in Connect, you've got to have Connect and Manage, where allow everyone to connect to the system, even if the network isn't capable, and deal with that through constraints afterwards. Because renewables targets were more important, and it was felt that, you know, the network itself was holding up.
I would say it probably predates that again to sort of the design of the market, because I always thought it's interesting if you go back and look at the kind of market design documents behind the trading arrangements that we have now. So back to like 1999, 2000, in them, there's all these assumptions about what's going to happen in terms of other locational signals in the market. So it's kind of recognized, sure, grand, you're going to have a single price zone. However, where do you see these transmission charges? They're going to send the best signals. And then obviously things moved on and things didn't happen.
Can I jump in there? I would just say, so in terms of Tom, what you say there is right, that the assumption originally was that we would always have enough network so that all generators at any time could supply electricity to all customers. And that sort of made sense when we had a small number of very large power stations distributed relatively evenly around the country and all well connected to customers through a strong transmission network. Now, the world we're moving into now is a world where we have lots of renewables. We have lots of wind concentrated in Scotland, off the east coast of England, North Wales, South Wales. And then we have lots of solar in the south, particularly in places like Cornwall and the rest of the south of England. And we could build enough network so that those generators could always supply power all around the country without any constraints. But actually, that would be extremely inefficient. It's much more efficient to allow constraints in some periods, which would then encourage customers to use electricity locally or encourage companies to build battery storage to store the electricity locally, or encourage them to build steel mills or hydrogen electrolyzers to use the electricity locally. And actually, it gives you a more efficient overall solution rather than just building huge amounts of network capacity.
That's the dream. Because, yeah, I mean, that's the as you said, Emma, that the idea was that Chinuos would do that, that people would see the... So Chinuos stands for the Transmission Network Use of System Charge and is the current zonal pricing mechanism that exists in the GB network. So it's a pound... For a generator, it's a pound per kilowatt signal that you pay a year with a tariff set a year in advance. But nobody really... It's important. It costs a lot of money, but it's hard to forecast and doesn't really have enough teeth or is clear and transparent enough to actually tell anyone you should build your power station here or you should build your electrolyzer here.
I guess, I suppose, yeah, in the context of the discussion around location and marginal pricing today, yeah, it's interesting to note that it's not, I suppose it's not a new discussion, right? The need for a locational signal has been recognized since the year dot, in terms of market design at least. The question of locational wholesale pricing, however, you know, I know that's been kind of kicked around for however many years in the kind of probably government and the regulator. And this was one of the main arguments against it, is how political it would be subdividing the country in different ways. What would you say, Ed, I suppose, in response to those kinds of concerns?
So what I would say is that So what you're saying there, the concern is that if you have locational pricing, electricity prices will be different in different parts of the country, and therefore some customers will have to pay more and some generators will receive either more or less. One thing I would say is you can design locational pricing so that all customers pay the same price regardless of where they are in the country. And that works in Italy. They have something called the PUN, which is a single price. I won't try and do the Italian. But they have a single price for demand across the whole country, whereas generators receive a regional price. And so you could just do that, and it would actually, in my view, it would still be worth it, and I think the modelling would show that out. So then the generators would be receiving different prices, and I think that's much less political, to say that generators should only be rewarded for the value that they create. Now, I would go a step further than that and say that we should be looking to extend this to customers, particularly for large industrial users. So we want our large industrial electricity customers to be located in industrial hubs that have good access to electricity. So think of somewhere like Teesside, Humberside, lots of offshore wind nearby, Grangemouth in Scotland, North Wales, Merseyside, South Wales as well, if you've got some floating wind in the Celtic Sea. So these are the types of places you want those businesses to connect. You want them to then be rewarded with low electricity prices, and then and that will hopefully make them internationally competitive. If you look at where large aluminium smelters are, large steel plants are, they are often in places with very cheap electricity. So places like Iceland, northern Sweden, places like Texas. So these are the kind of places where these plants go globally. We should have that in the UK.
There is one in Scotland, isn't there? I think there's one left.
Which one? The steel plant?
There's an aluminium smelter, I think.
The hydro one.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, which has a behind-the-meter hydro connection. At Lochaber, yes. So I guess showing the importance of cheap electricity. But at the moment, we're not allowing any industry in the country to receive very cheap prices, which means we're internationally uncompetitive. So it's much better to try and focus those new heavy industries, those green heavy industries in these areas that have access to cheap electricity from offshore wind.
And why should the mechanism for attracting those customers and those behaviours, why should that be locational marginal pricing compared to other initiatives in the space that might achieve some similar outcomes? So I'm thinking about things like local flexibility markets. So we talked to Randolph last week about all the stuff the DSOs are doing. even peer-to-peer flexibility. Why, in your mind, is locational marginal pricing the answer?
So any other solution, in my mind, basically becomes incredibly bureaucratic, where you've got aggregation of customers into these portfolios, you've got signing of contracts between customers and the distribution network operators, the national system operator. You've got a lot of complexity there and a lot of paperwork there, which raises the barrier to entry. But in addition, it's also inherently inefficient. So if you pay, so let's say you have a national price for electricity, you pay one set of generators in your national market. The ESO then picks up that schedule and says, okay, well, this is obviously isn't going to work because it's windy in Scotland today and all the wind can't get out of Scotland. So we're going to have to pay to turn lots of generators off, and we're going to have to pay to turn a whole other set of generators on. And that is you're creating additional cost there relative to if you just let the market give you the true schedule that takes into account the constraints up front, because you're paying people to turn off who, under locational marginal pricing, would never have been running in the first place. And also so I think the local flexibility markets of the heavy industry probably doesn't really work, because we're talking at quite a high voltage level here, so directly connected to the transmission network. So I think we'd be looking at instead at bespoke contracts between the ESO and the customer, which again are quite expensive, quite bureaucratic, there's not much price discovery. Or we're talking about using network charges, so TNUOS, as Tom raised earlier. And the problem with TNUOS, well, if I step back, there are two questions you need to be able to answer if you're building a hydrogen electrolyzer, let's say. Where do I build this plant, and at what hours of the day do I operate it? Now, TNUOS, in theory, can tell you where you should build your plant, but it cannot tell you at what hours of the day you should operate it, because it's a fixed annual charge. So then you get into, okay, well, maybe we should have variable network charges that vary at different times of day. Really, if you were going to do that, they would need to vary dynamically so that you pay more network charges only in periods where there are constraints. And then effectively you have created locational marginal pricing. You've just done it through another route. But it's much better just to do it in the wholesale market, which is what lots of markets around the world have been doing for years.
Yeah. So I think as a modeler and energy industry person, I'm definitely pro locational marginal pricing. I think I'm looking forward to charting it anyway. But I'm going to be a devil's advocate and ask you some of the tricky questions that I've heard on calls about them. So the first question I always get asked is this any different to TNUOS, because it's going to be complicated and difficult to forecast. So a lot of the complaints about TNUOS are that it's arbitrary, difficult to forecast, changes quite rapidly depending on changes in the system. Are those not just going to be multiplied, you know, by 48 times, by 8,760 times, and make investments harder to do and drive up the cost to consumer because the cost of capital will go up?
So I think these are valid concerns, particularly if you're making wholesale prices more volatile. What I'd say is there are two broad types of risk that I would talk about here. So one is market risk, the risk of market prices going up and down. And the other one is regulatory risk, so the risk that the rules change. So under TNUOS, we've seen quite a lot of market risk because we've seen the TNUOS be quite volatile. But we've also seen quite a lot of regulatory risk because there are always lots of proposals to change how TNUOS works. So, for example, there's changes at the moment. There was a code modification proposal looking at what assets would be chargeable, for example. So would the actual substation be chargeable rather than just the wires in between the substations? There was also a big change in the TNUOS methodology around rezoning. We were meant to go from 27 generator zones at the end of the current price or the last price control period to significantly more under the old rules.
Possibly hundreds.
Exactly. But and the reason for that is because the cost of connecting people at different places is very different. But there was a rule change to stop that happening. So again, that's another regulatory risk that you're running. So it's inherently, TNUOS is inherently quite arbitrary. What do you charge for? Where do you draw the zones, etc.? And inherently quite unstable, I would say, from a regulatory point of view.
That's a problem with the zonal market as well, not just the nodal market.
So if you go to a zonal wholesale market or a regional wholesale market like Italy, you have also have that combination of market risk and regulatory risk. Market risk, because the prices in the, let's say it was 12 zones, the prices in the 12 zones are going up and down. Different zones could have different prices from year to year. But you also have regulatory risk, because the zones could be withdrawn based on assessments of how much internal congestion there is within the zone, etc., etc., etc. So you're in a halfway house where you're still riding both risks. If you go all the way and you move to a nodal market or a local pricing market with thousands of zones or thousands of nodes, you no longer really have regulatory risk in terms of how your wholesale market and your network charges are designed, because your network charges become significantly simplified. But you do trade that off for a lot of market risk. But that's the kind of risk that investors, I would argue, are better placed to deal with. They can put in place power purchase agreements, PPAs, where they sell the power ahead for years in advance. They can buy financial transmission rights or FTRs to hedge the difference between their local price and a regional or national price reference node. And also they can buy or own battery storage, for example, which can help them offset that. So there's a lot less regulatory risk, a lot more market risk, but there are ways that investors can get around that. You might see changes to how they structure their portfolios to do that. But I think it's much better to, that's a risk that, that investors can manage, whereas regulatory risk is not one they can manage.
You talk about, I guess, yeah, market risk and regulatory risk, but I guess the interesting thing about electricity markets is ultimately regulations sit behind them and they're highly regulated. So it feels like there'll always be a degree of that in energy markets, like who controls the algorithm to determine the nodes or the zones or the prices. You know, there's a still a very, it's different as opposed to other markets in that way.
It is, and it's more of like a sort of pure economics experiment, because you can actually write down all of the rules. There is a centralized rulemaking authority, but as I said, I think it is a lot more stable once you get to nodal pricing. There are markets that have gone from national pricing to regional or zonal pricing, and then they have moved to nodal or local pricing in future. So, for example, Texas. But once markets get to nodal pricing, they tend not to go back, which suggests it's quite an inherently stable regulatory regime once you get it set up. And that tends to be quite good for investors. Investors can then plan and have confidence. And also, we're not talking about getting rid of CFDs necessarily. So we're not necessarily talking about getting rid of that. We're just talking about making sure the underlying price signals are as efficient as possible.
Yeah, because as long as the reference price is clear, then the strike price is known, then yeah, the investor should, well, for at least the length of the CFD, should be well catered for.
Yeah, and let's say, and some people say, oh, this is unfair on investors who are bidding for CFDs in this next round, for example, to make the change to this market. What I would say is it will not have a big impact on them during the 15 year of their CFD. They might need to renegotiate their PPA, and the PPA discounts that are applied for managing the balancing risk might change. And I understand that is quite a big issue, but it doesn't seem insurmountable necessarily. It does change the revenue they'd expect beyond year 15 at the end of their CFD contract. But I would say today, investors in current CFD projects should be aware that this is quite a big risk. This is not a new idea. This is something that's been talked about a lot ahead of this upcoming CFD auction, for example.
And they're already having to do similar things for Tenuos as well. So they're already looking at roughly
a similar thing. And remember, Tenuos is not something that is... changes in Tenuos are not compensated for under the CFD regime. So you're compensated for changes in losses and changes in Basuos, but you're not compensated for changes in Tenuos. Whereas under nodal pricing, local pricing, you would be compensated for changes in that local price during the CFD period and made whole back up to your strike price.
So the other kind of accusation devil's advocate question is, what about liquidity? In a national market, I've got lots of counterparties to trade with. The price is liquid, so there's lots of people posting bids and offers into the market, so I can be fairly confident in the price that I'm going to receive, the prices that have been traded. But in a nodal market, I might only have one or two counterparties, Will I receive a fair price? Will I find a counterparty? Will I just be exposed to imbalanced prices I can't predict? Will that not increase the cost of trading power for me and therefore reduce my revenues?
So I think that's that is an absolutely fair concern. I think what I'd say today is, yes, we have a lot of liquidity in the national market, and that's good for consumers. But then you get to the balancing market, which is where we unwind all the problems created by the fact that we have a national price rather than a local price, as well as doing other things around grid services. But then you get into the balancing mechanism today, and then you do have a locational market where National Grid is the only buyer. And so you do have problems then with lack of liquidity, you have problems with market power. And also, because the balancing mechanism is extremely bureaucratic, you have a problem with lack of participants. Whereas if you had a nodal market, it's much easier for small customers to participate through their supplier, with the supplier acting on their behalf. So I think we do have to be aware that there are issues with loss of liquidity and market power today that would also be present in a nodal market. In the nodal market, yes, there is less liquidity because there are fewer people that you can trade with. But one of the ways you get around that is by centralising the trading through a centralised clearinghouse run by the system operator or the market operator. You go back towards the pool, basically, in that all physical trading is done through the market operator, as it is done currently in Ireland and Northern Ireland in the ISEM, after the ISEM programme. So that's one way to get around it. Again, with the locational market power, you might have a scenario where a plant has market power in your nodal market. Before, that would appear in your balancing mechanism. Now it appears in your main wholesale market. That means the problem is still there, you've exposed the problem, and then you can think of strategies to cope with that. So, for example, in either California or Texas, or possibly both, I believe in Texas, there is an algorithm in the market clearing algorithm that applies bidding controls to plants with market power, but only in the trading periods where they have market power. So it's actually a really neat solution. You expose the market power, you put it in the centralized market clearing algorithm, and then you put in place automatically your market power mitigation measures in your main market in a transparent way, and only in the hours where that's necessary.
Out of interest, do you know how long it takes for Texas to clear their algorithm? Because I think they were saying it would take about 15 minutes to do TEAR for all of Europe.
So I don't know how long they take, but I know that California has 10,000 nodes, I believe. So the fact that they're able to run a market there with that level of nodes is not something that sort of worries me too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you should try and speak to somebody who understands how these algorithms work and what it is that adds complexity. So do you get problems with complexity when you add more nodes, or do you get problems with complexity when you add more types of order types, like fill or kill order types and things like that?
I think that was the issue with TEAR, is that there were a lot of kind of take this and you have to take the next three.
Yeah, because instead of a linear program, you've now gone to a non-linear program, and then there my expertise runs out. But I think it's worth, those are the sorts of questions actually that I hope will be answered by Ofgem's tender that they've recently released and probably awarded by now. It was a £350,000 tender to evaluate the potential for nodal local electricity pricing in Great Britain, including the costs and the benefits and some of the implementation challenges.
It's interesting as well that you mentioned probable need to have centralization of market clearing function to support this. And sort of, you mentioned a move back to the pool, which raised my eyebrows. I totally agree that move to a more centralized market feels a necessary next step in the net zero market transition. I think for this and other reasons, it'll be really important going forward. But that's also something that sort of can be politically difficult to message, given the history of our old electricity market that was a pool, and that was, you know, we got rid of that obviously for various different reasons. And we've kind of swung then to this very decentralized set of trading arrangements that we have now. And it almost feels like the pendulum needs to swing back the other way. Is that kind of how you see it?
I think so. As someone who's pro-market, I don't see anything anti-market about moving back towards centralised arrangements for physical trading. Because at the end of the day, we basically already have that anyway, because dispatch has to be done centrally. You can't have sort of no ESO and a complete free-for-all, because the ESO is managing all of these different problems on the network, all of the different power flows, all of the different non-active power issues. So not just the megawatts going down the lines, but also the reactive power, the inertia, things like that. And settlement has to be done centrally. So we have Elexon doing all the electricity settlement. So unless someone can come up with some completely decentralized way of trading electricity over finite networks, a bit more like the internet model maybe, if they can do that, then great. But where we are at the moment is that we do have a centralized electricity system operator. We're not going to be moving away from that. And we do have a centralized settlement system. So I have no problem with physical trading being done in a centralized way, noting that financial trading, as in Ireland, can be done in a decentralized way, although the market operator can also make markets for things like financial transmission rights, which is what happens in some of the US markets.
And I think it's probably important to note that going back to the point about reading the old market design documents, it was envisioned that the role for National Grid would be quite residual. And there's been a number of factors over time that have meant that National Grid's role has had to get bigger. You mentioned some of them there. So I think, yeah, it's about shifting to kind of more formally recognize that centralized role and maybe do it a bit better, maybe with, you know, more homogenous prices and clearing prices and as you're mentioning today, locational pricing.
Yeah, I think there's nothing residual today about the ESO's role in the electricity market. The ESO is a central player in the market. They have to be there. They have to be turning down generators at certain times of day in certain places, turning them up in other parts of the country. What locational pricing does is it sends the ESO back to that residual role, because the physics of the system, as far as possible, are represented in the market. And that's then the market doing the scheduling and the pricing. And then the ESO only steps in after that. And there are some really clever things you can do if you look in the US about how you co-procure both energy megawatts and reserve in the same market clearing algorithm. And I really would recommend reading some of the market reports in the US, like the New York ISO market report, talking about how they were integrating reserve requirements on the Long Island 110 kV network into their wholesale market. And that's like a big step forward, and it ends up reducing the cost of scheduling reserve in those areas. And I just think that's something we should be looking to do here as well.
Penultimate devil's advocate question. Another thing is that power stations are often sited near the kind of major fuel source or significant bottleneck, not where their network, you know, where their network wants them to be. Same thing for factories. They're often near something that's more important than electricity. So either workforce or, you know, nearest port or something like that. Why locational marginal pricing result in more efficient? Will it overcome the barriers to efficient locations like planning or those other factors that you have to take into account when siting electrical infrastructure?
So if nodal pricing doesn't overcome those challenges, for example, if everyone just stays in all the same locations, there's still an advantage in that the real-time dispatch is more efficient. So all the assets are all the same, they're all in the same places, but the real-time dispatch is more efficient. And in our modelling, or in the modelling that Aurora Energy Research did for Policy Exchange in December 2020, that more efficient dispatch was about half the benefit of locational pricing. It was only a three-zone model, so you know, you'd want to go further before implementing this. You'd want to do a full nodal model. The other half of the benefit was about siting of new generators and new sources of demand. Now, there is a natural turnover cycle where plants are retired and then new plants are built, both for factories and also for generators. That would be quite slow. But what we're seeing now is a huge expansion in both generation and demand. We're expecting electricity demand to double by 2050. So we're also expecting supply to double by 2050 and for it to be a lot of new renewables, for example. So there are now massive natural opportunities to locate this stuff in hub areas. And if you look at the political arguments for doing that, you look at the government's levelling up agenda, for example, a lot of that is focused on former industrial areas, that tend to be, well, they're certainly concentrated in hubs, But they're also often coastal. So Grimsby, Teesside, Scotland in Grangemouth, east of Scotland, maybe northeast Scotland as well, Merseyside, North Wales, South West Wales, Birmingham. So you've got a lot of hubs there, and all apart from Birmingham are coastal. So there's a huge synergy between offshore wind and industry in those areas, electric vehicle manufacturing, for example, and also hydrogen production. If we're going to have green hydrogen, it should probably be in the areas where the offshore wind is coming onshore.
Or where the hydrogen is going to be used.
Well, quite. But yes, the hydrogen may be used there, but also if it's going to be transported to the sort of local or regional area, it certainly makes sense to do that not in London, for example. It wouldn't make too much sense to put lots of electrolyzers in London because the network is going to be a lot more constrained.
Final devil's advocate question. The electricity industry does not have an amazing track record of delivering large-scale IT infrastructure projects. So I'm specifically thinking of the electricity balancing system reform, which was, what, £100 million over budget and never got delivered. How this is likely to be a multi-year project. Is it worth the delay and the uncertainty to go ahead and the cost with such an enormous change?
Well, so I obviously think it is, which is why I'm here. I think whatever your long-term view of how the electricity system should operate, efficient locational dispatch is going to be right at the heart of that. So whether you're pro equivalent firm power auctions that Dieter Helm has proposed, or whether you're pro sticking mandates on suppliers to ensure security supply and decarbonisation, or whether you're pro just having an energy-only market, whichever vision you have for the long term of the electricity sector, efficient locational dispatch, for me, sits at the heart of that. So in a sense, this is a sort of low regrets option, but also a very big potential upside option. And I'm really interested to see what numbers the Ofgem commissioned modelling comes up with. Yes, it's a long programme. We reckon it would be 5 or 6 years from the day that the Secretary of State stands up and says, we want to do this, to the day when we go live on the 1st of April in whatever year we're in. But I don't think it has to lead to huge uncertainty, because locational marginal pricing, local nodal pricing, these are models that operate across the whole world, in the United States, in Singapore, in New Zealand, in Chile. So it's not like the Tenuos call for evidence that's just come out, for example, where who knows where that's going to end up. It's not like the network access and forward-looking charges significant code review. It's not even like the offshore transmission network review, where it's actually not really that clear what the outcome is going to be. With a programme of nodal pricing, it is pretty clear what the fundamentals of that system would look like.
It's a solved problem in other markets.
Yes, I mean, there's certainly pretty stable implementations of nodal pricing in other markets. Yes, I'm sure they could be better, in the same way that we all argue in the energy industry about everything that could be better here. But it's not, we don't need to reinvent the wheel here. There are off-the-shelf models that we could implement, certainly in terms of the market rules. The IT, I'm sure, would be bespoke, and some of the network codes would take quite a while to unwind, I'm pretty sure.
You said, I was quite struck by a thing you sent me for the Texas LNP change, where they had a payback within a year.
That was their cost benefit analysis. And then that benefit comes every year, because it's both that more efficient dispatch, which happens every year, and then your more efficient investment, which grows over time, because you're putting projects in the right place, they're then operating more efficiently, and then as old projects retire and new ones are built, you get more and more benefits relative to the status quo.
And I've got one. I'm off devil's advocate mode now, but how far down do you think we should go in terms of nodes?
So California has several thousand nodes, so I don't see any reason why we shouldn't do that. If we were to do that in Great Britain, that would include going down onto the distribution network. In California, they might say they don't go onto their distribution network, but presumably they're going to relatively low voltages, so at voltages that would be on our distribution network. So I don't see any reason not to go to the distribution network in Great Britain. I think you were saying last week on your podcast that there are about 350 nodes on the transmission network, the grid supply points. There are probably a couple of thousand at the level below, which is the bulk supply point, the BSPs, the 132 kV substations. I would like to hope you could get down to the primary substations, which is the level below that, the 3311 kV substations, but maybe you could only get to the bulk supply points, the 132 kV network. But that is the sort of thing that could be phased over time, because there is not currently live monitoring on all primary substations on the whole 33 kV network, but there is at all the GSPs, for example, have live monitoring, and a lot of the, I think probably all of the BSPs do as well. But that's the sort of thing you could phase over time, and you could align it with your network investment program of rolling out live metering on the distribution networks. So at the moment, there are some distribution network substations where they can tell you how many megawatts are flowing through the substation, but they don't know which direction it's going in, for example. So that's the sort of thing you would need to upgrade if you wanted to extend local pricing to that substation. But also, you should be doing that anyway, because you can't monitor your substation properly if you don't know which way the power's going.
We've talked about locational pricing from the perspective of generators quite a bit. I suppose in this context, how would a supplier of domestic customers see this change or see an impact on its customer base?
So there could be no impact whatsoever. You could just not extend this to domestic customers whatsoever. You could do it on an opt-in basis, where customers have to actively opt in to receive a nodal price. But you need some safeguards to make sure that you don't just cherry pick the best customers. And I went into quite a lot of detail on how to do this in some of my reports for Policy Exchange. And basically it involves applying a fixed pence per kilowatt hour charge to that customer or to their supplier to bring their average annual nodal price up to the national average, so that all customers, all domestic customers, I think it's right, they should all have the same average bill if they make no behaviour change, whilst seeing different short-term price signals, or whilst their supplier sees different short-term price signals, for example. And that, to be honest, it is quite complicated, but I think that is an important principle, that no domestic customer should pay more for their electricity because of where they live. So if they want a flat tariff, wherever they live in the country, it should be approximately the same. I think that's an important principle there.
But does that not undermine signals on the customer to react?
Not really, because if it's the average price, that's telling them to sort of move house, because the average electricity price here is too high. Let's say that's not a signal we want to send. So you apply it as a fixed pence per kilowatt hour charge in every period. So the variable charge still has a price shape to it. So you're still maintaining the shape of the short-term price signal, even whilst everyone's facing the same average price. What that might mean in practice is that someone in Cornwall might have a tariff that during the summer has a low price period during the middle of the day when it's typically sunny, whereas someone in Scotland might have a tariff that has a low price period overnight when it's typically the wind is higher than demand, for example. Or you might have a dynamic tariff where on sunny days there's a price plunge in the middle of the day, or if you're in Scotland on windy nights, you have a price plunge in the overnight period. And that could then inform how that customer charges their car, for example. So it's not about giving everyone fully nodal prices, that they're paying the half hourly nodal price at their node at all times. It's about trying to send some relatively broad signals to customers and their suppliers about what they should be doing at different times of day and different times of year in order to save money, particularly with electric vehicles and heat pumps.
And then you can layer that with network charges to average things out if there's an over or under recovery, and you can have your net local flexibility markets for, you know, if there's a network issue that isn't encapsulated within the market price. So you could still have all of that stuff.
Absolutely. So let's say you were in a town in Cornwall, you might have one price. That might just be one node, but there'll be different streets within that town. So you might still need a local flexibility market, because you might have one street where everyone's charging their car in the middle of the day and they're sort of frying the wires. But it's quite likely that people in neighbouring streets will have similar behaviour. So therefore, the price reflected at the node in the town is similar to what the network needs at the individual street level. But that might not be the case, and that's why there would still be a residual need for flexibility markets.
That leads me on to the other cool thing that you see in markets that have locational marginal pricing, is that there's often a surplus between areas. So if one price is high in one area because there's a constraint, somewhere someone has captured that arbitrage difference. And in some markets, they give that to the network operator and it's used to determine where investment should go or whether or not you should relieve constraints. Because then you have a kind of, the other cool thing is you have this competition then between the networks and storage and generation, because the networks could go off, you know, for the last 10 months, whatever, the price has been really high in one area and low in another. We could capture a whole bunch of that with an FTR and we'll build a line to do that. Or a storage operator could go, hold on, if I build some lithium ion batteries here, I can capture the price because it's always high at this end of the day and then become a virtual transmission line and send it over later when the price rises in the other zone and the constraint goes down. Or a generator could choose where to go. And that's another cool thing about locational marginal pricing is you start bringing
Or a large customer could choose where to go as well.
Exactly.
And you've seen, for example, Google, for example, with their data centers, they're now talking about wireless energy arbitrage, where you send jobs to the data centers in the areas of the world that have lowest electricity prices in real time, which is also the cleanest electricity. And I mean, that's kind of crazy, but it's a pretty cool example of the sort of possibilities this opens up. You can never have, so let's use that Google example there. Either you have that through markets that show you that, or you have some sort of super global TSO sort of demand response management project product that basically would never happen. And so you wouldn't end up with that sort of behavior. But if you put it in the market, you basically unleash all of this innovation and people find ways of sort of making money and reducing costs and are fully aligned. It doesn't get rid of the need for new network investment. And actually, even in markets with nodal pricing, there are still big transmission projects. So Texas, for example, had the Renewable Energy Zones project where they procured a whole load of transmission, a whole load of new transmission to be built so that wind could be built in upstate or mid Texas to come down into the cities in the south of Texas. So there's no reason why it means you don't get transmission. It just means that the decisions that you make might be a bit different. And I'm sure in some circumstances, your transmission operator would be saying to the regulator, I need to do this project, I need to do this new line. And they find out that someone's already gone and built a battery to solve the problem, or gone and built a hydrogen electrolyzer to soak up all of the cheap power. So because a lot of these sort of generation demand projects move quicker than networks, you might find that actually the network problem in some cases would be solved by the market before the transmission operator has to go and build a line.
Hmm.
It's all a bit rosy, isn't it, the picture that I'm painting?
Yeah.
Well, or a bit complicated. I'm just trying to think about all these different parties competing and having different time frames. And
but the point is, we don't need to be able to imagine exactly how every element would work, because you now have all of us, let's say we were all three different battery storage developers. We don't need to know what each of us is doing in order to get batteries built in the right places because of locational marginal pricing. Or maybe I'm a battery developer building batteries all over Great Britain. You might be a hydrogen developer and Tom might be a green steel manufacturer. And we all have the same incentives to try and soak up cheap power when it's available. At the moment, we really don't have those incentives. So there is no business case, or much less business case for us at the moment than what there would be under this new market.
Well, Ed, I'm sold. Sign me up. Any concluding thoughts?
I would just say I think there are chances now for this to happen. We've had a big energy crisis. It's mainly related to international gas prices, but it is putting the energy market and the electricity market in particular, well, the electricity market and the gas market are both under scrutiny. And I think this issue of constraints on the electricity market is one that really will be salient. And I think what I'll be arguing is that the next crisis could come along from not solving this problem. If we have 40 gigawatts of wind on the system, offshore wind on the system by 2030, and we haven't implemented locational marginal pricing, I am worried that customers won't fully benefit from the falling cost of that offshore wind. So that's why this market reform is so important.
I mean, I think my key takeaway is that you've got the benefits of operational decisions, and you can still have all of your layers on top. So it's really whether or not people locate more efficiently because of electricity pricing is not necessarily here or there in my view, because I still think having CFDs and capacity markets are the way forward. But you can have LMP nodal pricing at the same time, and you get that operational benefit no matter where people locate. And that's huge. That's my takeaway, I think.
Thank you very much for listening. Thanks, lads.
Thank you, Emma.
That was a laugh.